We're excited to have Robert Kirby with us, and I can tell by the response when we first mailed out the program and people came back that a lot of you are really excited to have him visit again. I guess he was here 3 years ago or so, and was a huge hit, and so it's neat to have him back with this group. I'll do my best to introduce him off the cuff. I've been aware of him for a lot of years. He, like me, like a lot of you, I'm sure, he's just helped you. Helped you be LDS and to feel certain tensions. I don't know that he's ever done this, but there's the great trickster tradition from various traditions, the court jester, the holy fool, the person, all this fun anthropological literature, that there's these people who play these roles that are very important for societies. Sometimes it's a pressure valve role and the ability to release pressure. But every single one of these holy fools, of these tricksters, these guys, there's a wisdom and there's a truth there. And as I wrote the little blurb introducing him and saying he's the author of this book and this book and this book and this book, I deliberately put in there, and other important studies, you know, how did I word it? I should have other important Mormon studies. And I really think that that's what we have with Robert Kirby. As someone who's very insightful, and he sees this in an important way, and I really see these books as study. You normally wouldn't think Patton Kirby as an important study. Wake Me for the Resurrection, Sunday of the Living Dead. One of the books are out there. In fact, I want to encourage you all. It's Mother's Day next Sunday. This is not too early to Christmas season. We have out there, we have Patton Kirby Go to Hell. Which used to come with a heck sticker as an optional little thing that you could put over it. I don't know what happened, if you're going to reprint those heck stickers ever again or not. But
the
stickers sold better. But that's out there. We also have one of his more recent things. After he went, he was just a Saturday-only columnist for the Tribune, and then he went to, now he's twice a week, besides the Saturday, and that broadened his focus, and not always on religion. And so Family Home Screaming is another one of his things sort of geared around the observations of just daily life that he's really doing. He's just a very popular columnist. His first book was called Happy Valley Patrol, and I'm sure he'll tell a little bit about it. And it was written under the pen name John Blitz Krieg. And it was kind of I won't anticipate what he's going to say. But so if you think you have all the Robert Kirby books, you may not have them all if you didn't know about that. We also have out there Dark Angel, which is one of his few novels and things. So anyway, please visit out there and pick up books. Let me just do the more serious stuff. He and his wife Irene are here, and they're staying with the Linfords, and we know that they're enjoying having them in their home. And they're the parents of three children, three girls. Two of them are married, and one more. For those of you who've read them, know that they've been identified with Springville, Utah for years and years and years. My understanding is just in a few weaving to Harriman, Utah, which is out of Happy Valley, but just barely, right there on near the point of the mountain, a little bit to the west. So we're excited to have him speak with us, enlighten us. We're going to laugh, we're going to learn, and we're going to feel better about ourselves as he holds up a fun and interesting mirror. So thanks very much. Please welcome Robert Kirby.
Thank you. I always like coming to Sunstone because you get great material here. It's almost as good as church. While Mike was talking, I kept thinking up this column. I got to write a column about Mormon suicide bombers. And making it sort of a priesthood calling. The Relief Society would actually make the little dynamite vests and... You have plastic explosive shaped like little bunnies and just for grapes. There you go. Yeah, grapes. Have you done your suicide bombing for the month? Um, when I heard Omar talk out in San Francisco, I decided I needed to know more about Islam and Muslims, because that's going to play a major role in the world in the years to come. And you need to understand other people. And the more I learn about other peoples, the more I realize that we share so much in common. So I picked up this book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Understanding Islam. And it's, I mean, I've learned a lot of stuff that I didn't know before. For example, in Islam, women have always been regarded as equal to men in the eyes of God. There was never any distinction between their being on the same level, whereas in Christianity, it took us about 300 years to figure out, after the death of Christ, that women even had souls. So, you learn these interesting things about other religions, but the most interesting thing I learned was about where Muslims go when they die if they've been bad. And here's a level of hell. The inmates of hell will wear clothing made of burning pitch, drink from fountains of burning oil, eat barbed fruit that looks like devil heads, and never have a moment's rest from it. Every time a person's body will be burned up or destroyed, a fresh body or layer of skin will materialize so that the punishment can be felt anew. And that sounds just like high priest group. I thought, we're truly brothers. It's nice to be here right now, especially considering what's going on back at the Salt Lake Tribune. For those of you who have not been paying attention, people are getting fired left and right back there over this, the issue of the National Enquirer story and the Smart family. How many of you have been kind of following it or know what's going on back there? For those of you who don't, two Salt Lake Tribune reporters sold some of their information, a lot of information actually, to the National Enquirer regarding the Elizabeth Smart disappearance. And when it came out, they were summarily disciplined, fired on the spot. The editor had just resigned Friday night. I guess when I flew in, I found that out. And so all of that is going on while I'm 1,500 miles away from it. And every time I talk to the newspaper, all the editors wish they were out here with me. So it is a true pleasure to be here. I apologize in the very beginning for people who've heard me talk before. I tend to say pretty much the same thing. That usually works out to be what people want to hear, as opposed to what I would prefer to talk about. I have gotten in trouble, I've been in trouble with the church probably three times in an official capacity based on what I write, which is essentially lampooning Mormonism. Which they're my family, and so it's easy to do. Sort of like picking on your own little sister. You can do it, but nobody else can. And most recently, I was called in by my stake president, who had just become my new stake president, and he wanted to get to know me. And he said, I went down and I met with him, and he says, well, the previous stake president actually had a newspaper subscription coming to the steakhouse so that he could read what you write every week and make sure that everything was okay. And he says, I've sort of canceled that because you sometimes make me squirm, but there's nothing really dangerous about what you write. And I said, you're trying to tell me what I write is just essentially stupid stuff, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, that's good, because I have in the profession of journalism, where stupidity is actually regarded as a virtue. You can say really outlandish stuff, and that's just the sort of thing that people expect from you. So even if you're saying something because you're ignorant, it actually works in your favor. They can't tell whether you're fooling or not. The previous stake president and I had a couple of confrontations. When I always try to take a humorous approach to everything that is going on, and when the LDS Church clashed with the Jewish community over baptisms for the dead and the temple ordinances being done for the victims of the Holocaust, a lot of people were up in arms about that, and I came up with this program, I figured out a way to make money on this. I said, if you don't like this sort of stuff being done for your ancestors, I've got this thing called excommunication for the dead. And for $100, I'll just, make it go away. And he called me in and he said, "Now that's not really a good idea to do." And I said, "Well, that's because it's a joke." Nobody's really going to do that, are they? The first time I got into trouble with my stake president, and I sort of sensed that it was going to be coming because it was very difficult to predict how far you could go writing humor about Mormons before you cross some sort of invisible line. And he called me in shortly after I'd written a column about why I was not afraid of church leaders. There had been a lot of people who'd gotten in trouble for things they had written about the church. Some had been excommunicated and whatnot. And when the humor thing sort of hit the pages, everybody wondered how long is it going to take before he gets into trouble. And so I was constantly asked if I was afraid of church leaders. And so I wrote a column and I said I wasn't afraid of church leaders because they're old. which is pretty much true. I said, all things being equal, I'm pretty sure I could beat President Hinckley up. And I didn't say that I wanted to. I simply said that if it was just the president and I out behind the temple and push came to shove, I could probably take him. I noticed you didn't bring that up, Mike. Oh, okay. All right. And I wrote it and drove home, and I thought a little bit later that was a really bad idea. Because even though I know that there's a line out there somewhere, I've always been sort of careful to stay back from it just enough to stay out of trouble. But this pretty much crossed the line where you go around saying you can beat up general authorities. And if there's a place in the world where you shouldn't say stuff like that, it's probably Utah. But it was done, and so when I went to work the next day, I was really nervous about all the mail I would get. And I was almost certain that this would result in some sort of disciplinary action, either from the church that would pressure my job or my employer to do something about me, or being called into the nursery again. Wasn't exactly sure how that was going to spin. And so I was very nervous. And I came to work, and there was nothing. There was just dead silence. Nobody said anything. Nobody called the paper. Nobody wrote any letters. Nobody said a word. And it was just, the silence was so eerie, I didn't know what to do with it. And I realized right then that there was no predicting what would set people off, especially when you consider that 2 weeks later, I wrote a column where I said, you can tell the difference between God and Satan by the types of pets they have. God has this really cool dog named Vern, and Satan has a cat, and I got 500 letters from cat owners. It was really strange. I looked at all this mail and thought, what the hell is the matter with these people? And I said I could beat up President Hinckley, and nobody says anything, and I write this stupid thing about cats, and I got poems about cats and pictures of cats, and one guy sent me a photocopy of his cat's butt. And so I realized that there was no way to predict what people would find offensive, and so I thought I'd just go for it. But I actually did get in a little bit of trouble over the President Hinckley thing about 4 months after the column ran. And that's the risk that you run when you lampoon someone with an eternal perspective of things, is that 4 months to them is like tomorrow. And so they thought they were immediately moving on this. And when my stake president called and wanted to talk to me, I didn't know what he wanted. And I'd already done some other stuff, and so I drove down to see him, and he, my stake president then was your typical Mormon authority, somewhat humorless, well, considerably humorless, and really interested in making sure that all the coloring stays inside the lines, and it was pretty clear that we don't come from the same part of God's palate, and so when we sat down to talk, he said very formally, "You wrote a column several months ago where you said you could beat up President Gordon B. Hinckley." And I said, "Yeah, no, I can." And when you say things to people and the humor comes at them from an angle that they're not used to, you can actually watch their face and their brain have a race. So he said, "Well, be that as it may, don't you think that's a little irreverent?" And I said, "Well, maybe a little." And he said, "Well, I have a note here from one of the brethren asking me to talk to you. He apparently thinks it's a lot. And they want interested in getting you to tone it down a little bit." Which is fair. I mean, I'm a Mormon, and as such, I sort of submit myself to a certain amount of ecclesiastical authority. I mean, there is an element of cooperation required in any institution that you choose to belong to. And so I ended up having this telephone conversation / interview with this general authority up in Salt Lake, and I won't tell you who it was, but it went really well. He was very nice. It always goes well. He said, well, and he explained why he thought this particular column crossed the line regarding humor and religion, and I explained why I thought it was funny, and I even got into the doctrine of how you make a joke. He still didn't think it was funny. And so I thought it's entirely possible that I offended President Hinckley. He seems like a man with a pretty good sense of humor, but I didn't really know. So I went home and I wrote him a letter of apology. I said, "Dear President Hinckley, I'm sorry I said I could beat you up. In my defense, I did not say that I wanted to. I was simply trying to make a joke. I hope you understand that it's the nature of my job to do this sort of thing. However, if you were offended, I do apologize and we'll try to do a little bit better in the future. P.S. I think I could still beat up the Pope." Because in the column, I said that I could beat up the Pope, too, and that Mother Teresa couldn't take a punch, and Billy Graham was sick, so really, why would I be afraid of church leaders? And I sent it off and thought that would be the end of it, but a couple of weeks later, I went out to my mailbox, and there was this pretty scary envelope from the office of the First Presidency. And, I mean, I've been beating Mormons up for 10 years now. And that's the only time I've ever been truly terrified. Because this thing looks so official. All I could do was stare at it for a long time. And I couldn't shake this thought that, crap, I'm going to Africa. It happened just like this before. But I finally opened it up, and it was... it was actually a note from one of President Hinckley's secretaries who said, "I've discussed the matter with the president. He wishes me to assure you that he is not offended. Good luck. Have fun." So now when I get called in, I take this letter with me. It's what I consider to be my true mission call. They can look at it, but they can't touch it. In that particular vein, I began doing this lampooning of the LDS culture back there because of a certain amount of distress I experienced when my family moved to Utah back in the early 70s. I'd been raised in a military family. We lived all over the world, and it was very difficult to move to a society where everybody looked alike and behaved alike and dressed alike, and in most cases, were related. Because I was used to a multicultural environment. I had a lot of friends who were black or Hispanic growing up, and when I would go play at their homes, I was exposed to a lot of different ways of living. And when you do that, you sort of tend to push aside the things that you have in difference and focus on the things that you have in common, and you really develop a kinship with other people. Well, I moved to Utah, and that sort of vanished. My father bought a home in Holiday, and we were suddenly surrounded by all these white people. And I hated it for the longest time until I realized that it wasn't just Mormons I was upset at. I was suffering from sensory deprivation. It was just this solid wall of white. And not very attractive white at that. And I had to find some way to deal with that. And for the first 10 or 15 years of being in Utah, the way of dealing with that was anger. And unfortunately, that was very counterproductive and it wasn't very fun either. Eventually, I hit on writing about it. And that occurred after I'd gone on an LDS mission and come back to Utah and became a police officer. And when you're a police officer in Utah, you develop this serious kinship with the Roman centurions in Jerusalem about the time of Christ. You may be God's chosen people, but there's something seriously wrong with you. And one day, I was reading something that Bonner Ritchie had written, and that sort of clicked the light on for me. It was, for me, one of those moments you're supposed to get with the Book of Mormon. It just kind of badly made sense. I don't remember the entire article, but the one thing that he said in it was that there was no way you can make organizations safe for individuals. You can only make individuals safe for organs. And that made so much sense because I was ill-fitting trying to be like everybody else in this organization. And I really only needed to be myself and to make a place for myself and people like me in this great institution called the church. And there's still an element of anger involved in there, in that what I write is just the way I choose to cope with going to church with other kinds of people. The fact remains, though, is that this, when I talk about other people, I'm not just talking about Mormons, I'm talking about all sorts of people, including Sunstoners, because we all have that one thing that we like to call our sacred cow. For some people, it's their testimony of the church. For other people, it's their testimony about something else. And you can get into trouble when you start picking on people's sacred cows. The problem with human beings and sacred cows is that when we have a sacred cow, we want another one. And pretty soon, we sort of want a sacred herd. And so the sphere of influence for our sacred cow starts to grow. And then you want a sacred barn to put your herd in. And then a sacred farm to put the barn on. And see, as it expands, so does your ego to sort of defend these sacred things. And I'm sure you've heard it said before that sacred cows make the best hamburger. And that's where it comes to people like me. I consider myself a satirist. And as such, it is not my job to degrade people as much as it is to remind them that they already are. Because no matter how high the throne you sit on, you still sit on your bottom. And it's a lampoonist's job to sort of remind human beings that we all have these foibles. I got into lampooning Mormons after reading this thing by Bonner Ritchie, which turned me on. When I left police work and got into journalism, I went to work for a small newspaper in Utah County, and one day the editor came to me and said, "Will you write us an editorial?" It was one we had ready to go for the newspapers falling through, and we need it right away. And I said, "Yeah, I can do that." And for those of you who aren't familiar with journalism terms, an article is kind of an objective look at something. You lay the things out in a very objective way and let the reader make up his or her own mind about the conclusion. A column, on the other hand, is the personal opinion of whatever idiot wrote it. And an editorial by the newspaper is the exact actual official position of the newspaper on a given subject. I didn't know that. I was just this cop who knew how to spell. So I sat down and I wrote this thing called Five Kinds of Mormons. And I hypothesized of all the millions of Mormons there were in the world, there were only five basic types. There were liberal Mormons, there were genuine Mormons, of which there's only about 11, conservative Mormons, Orthodox Mormons, and Nazi Mormons. And I explained how to recognize all the different types and put it on his desk and went home. And he called me later that night and said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "What's wrong?" And he goes, "Well, this isn't very funny and it's not very nice." I said, "Well, you better not run it." But he did. And it was in the paper the next day when I went to work, and there was a picture of me next to it. And sort of my column was sort of born in that moment. Thanks, Bonner. And I was sitting there reading it when the doors of the newsroom burst open, and in stormed the publisher of the newspaper, and being of the latter category of Mormon. He was rather upset about this and went over and yelled at the editor about the bad journalistic sense it was to write something like this in Utah County, which I tell everyone is the Tehran of Utah. And he predicted we were going to get very angry letters to the editor, and he was right, because he went back up to his office and he wrote the first one. And unfortunately, it was the only one we got. All the other letters that came, and there were a lot of them, condemned the publisher for his lack of a sense of humor. That they knew Mormons like this, they liked Mormons, and he should grow up. And so two things occurred to me as a result of that. One was that there was actually a market for this sort of humor about our culture. And the second thing was that I needed a new job. Because when I wouldn't quit doing it, they fired me. But I have the Tribune picked me up right away. Go figure. And I've sort of been doing that ever since. And I've learned some interesting things about how humor works when you go after people's sacred cows. You have to do it, I believe, in kind of a loving way to let them know that you do care about them, but sometimes their behavior is a little outlandish. This isn't just an issue about Mormons, though. It's an issue about human beings, about any time we focus our attention on our agenda so tightly that we sort of lose perspective. And when that happens, we kind of become ripe for lampooning. And it's P.J. O'Rourke, I'll give you an example, said that he, after writing an article about the born-again Christian movement in the United States, he said that making fun of born-again Christians was like hunting dairy cows with a high-powered rifle and a scope. It's just so easy, in large part because they were so full of themselves that they just couldn't get out of the way if they tried. And so making fun of Mormons was just like that. But here's the problem. People will sometimes believe that because I lampoon Mormons, I'm on their side when it comes to the whole Mormon issue, and I'm not. You may not be part of the local herd, but you're still a cow. This is how it works in politics. In 1994, researchers in Denmark discovered that men have, on average, 4 billion more brain cells than women. And it's not collectively either. It's that our heads are physically bigger than yours, and so there needs to be a little bit more stuff to fill it up with, and it works out to be about 4 billion extra brain cells per man. It didn't say that men were smarter than women, or even that we used the brain cells that we had, only that we had them. And so I wrote this column and explained why historically women weren't smart enough to think up very important social issues like impersonating Elvis. And or professional wrestling. I mean, if you look back over time, you'll never see a period when women were smart enough to come up with a way to break some other person's spine using just their forehead. That it had to be a man. And other things that men thought up that were necessary were monster truck racing, thermonuclear warfare, grain alcohol, sacrificing people to idols. And the column ran, and I got this letter back from this woman about 3 minutes later. You pig. Men are not smarter than women because they thought up professional wrestling. What good does that do anyone? Sacrificing people to idols is not only stupid and damaging, but it serves no purpose and didn't help the human race at all. For people like this, the arms are down and the lights are flashing, but there's no train coming. And that's what makes what I do so great. Writing a satirical column is like being on Idiot Safari. I don't even have to agree with what I write. I just, as a way of driving the game out into the open. And sure enough, they'll pop up and start yelling, and you can say, see, there's one. And there's another one. It's a little tougher, though, when the game is your own. I wrote a column, and you sort of have to kind of lead people along carefully if you want them to laugh at themselves in a constructive way. And there's a social benefit to doing that that we'll get to in a minute. I wrote a column at the very beginning of this sojourn where I said that Mormons, when we sing in church, we sound like an anesthetized dairy herd. And which is true if you compare our music to other people's. And this woman called the newspaper to yell at me. And the irony here was that she had just moved into my ward. So she didn't know who I was, but I knew who she was. And so she got me on the phone. She just figured I was this jerk at the paper. She said, "You must not be a Mormon to say these terrible things about us." I said, "No, I'm a Mormon." And she said, "Well, you must be an inactive Mormon to be so cruel." I said, "No, I go to church all the time." And she said, "Well, then you must be on the verge of apostasy, then, to say this kind of stuff." And I said, "Well, actually, no, I'm in your bishopric." And she said, "Oh," and hung up. And then she called back a few minutes later and said, "I've read the column again, and I've decided that there is some humor here." I don't know what had changed in that time, but I'll bet it wasn't her sense of humor. And I mean, the difficulty in finding something that everybody can laugh at is illustrated in this particular story, but it's also illustrated in the story about saying that I could beat President Hinckley up, because here you have one general authority who is upset by this, and another about whom the story was about it actually finds it somewhat amusing and is very self-effacing about it. And it's just too difficult to predict what makes people upset. Are there places you should not go with humor? Yeah, there are. I don't make fun of LDS temple ordinances any more than I would Catholic Mass. There are areas where I choose not to go, not because I don't find humor in those situations, but because I have a certain amount of respect for their beliefs, the things that they hold sacred, provided that it doesn't infringe on, you know, too much on me. There are a lot of things that are funny about the temple, and there are a lot of things that are very serious about them, and there are a lot of things that have elements of both. I was a police officer in Utah for 11 years, and if you want a real treat, get pulled through the veil by somebody you threw in jail. There is a reason why human beings laugh, why we like to laugh. It is a safety valve for us in a lot of different ways. The first way I'd like to talk about is psychologically. We need laughter in coping with the rigors of life. So much of life we have no control over. We really only have control over how we perceive it or how we choose to react to what goes on in the life. And learning how to laugh, teaching yourself how to laugh, is essential to being able to cope with those things. Mark Twain said it best. He said that laughter is the only self-defense mechanism that human beings really have. I mean, ultimately, life is going to kill you anyway. And it's important to know what things should be taken seriously and what things that you just need to laugh off because there's nothing you can do about them. Police officers, people in public safety profession, understand that, I think, a little bit better than other people because they can do so many terrible things in the course of doing their job. And so they develop sort of a dark sense of humor, and they laugh about pretty terrible things as a way of coping with them. I learned that fairly early on as a police officer, in large part because I'm always looking for victims. When I became a police officer, I would pull people over for speeding and understand right away that if I kept a perfectly straight face, I could say virtually anything and they'd believe me. So you pull them over and ask them for their license and all their major credit cards, they'll give them to you. And you can have so much fun with that. I mean, you just say, we're just checking credit limits, yours are fine. And most people will laugh, but there are always those who will go, oh, well, thanks. I started out as a police officer in Tooele County, which I tell everyone is where God practiced making people before he got really good at it. And eventually moved to Utah County, and when we would run roadblocks, they're looking for drunk drivers. People would pull through them, and they have that typical Mormon response to authority. Authority must be obeyed, and authority will never lead you wrong. And so when they pull up to me and want to know what was going on, I'd say, we're looking for Democrats. And a lot of people would laugh, but there were those few, those precious few, who would say, oh dear, we don't even know any Democrats. Well, we sure hope you catch them, though. It is possible, as we were saying, though, about humor, to go too far. I stopped this guy for speeding one time, and he gave me his driver's license and his registration, but then he gave me his tempo recommend, which I thought was really interesting. So I'm back at the car. I wrote him a ticket for speeding, and then on his tempo recommend, I wrote void. And to this day, I wish I had on video his face when I gave it back to him. If we're talking about your brain and your face having a race, this was a marathon. He just sat there and looked at it. He was pretty upset about it, too. And so was his stake president. And so was his stake patriarch, who happened to be my police chief. So, if you ever get a chance to do that, I wouldn't if I were you. I got 2 days off without pay for that. It's not like, you know, in the church where if you do something the brethren don't like and you apologize, they have to forgive you. In the police department, they don't. There are the physical benefits to humor. We talked a little bit about the psychological benefits to humor. The physical benefits to humor are great because when we laugh, our body produces T lymphocytes and gamma interferon and a host of other disease-fighting cells that make us healthier. We laugh, we also get kind of a mini aerobic workout. Our blood pressure goes up a little bit, and so does our heart rate. But best of all, our brains produce beta endorphins, which are the body's own morphine. It helps you get through times of being seriously injured or high-stress moments. So you actually get physically high when you laugh when your body produces these endorphins. And the problem with that is that, like every other drug, if you abuse it long enough, pretty soon you need more in order to maintain the same level of funny, and that's when you start getting into trouble for doing things that you shouldn't. Like teaching your ward how to play Choose the Wife. My wife and I have this way of staying awake in church by pretending that polygamy has returned and we have to choose three other wives from the congregation, from women in the congregation. And it's damn hard to do that. I mean, we can usually agree on two. I mean, she gets her pick and I get my pick. But the tiebreaker, you know, sort of that third one we always get stuck on, and it always turns out to be somebody really old and mean. And that, more than anything, has convinced me of that there was no merit to polygamy. I actually like this violence thing better. I don't know what you were trying to say, Mike, but I have a greater feeling of kinship with Joseph Smith now. Social benefit to humor. In Utah, when I started lampooning my own culture, everybody recognized that I was a Mormon and that I was saying things, and it was difficult for them to sort of figure it out. Why would a Mormon, someone from a traditionally non-self-deprecating group of people, be saying these sorts of things? And initially, the non-Mormons believed it was because I was transitioning out of the church and I was going to join their ranks. And the Mormons also tended to believe the same thing. Unfortunately, neither was true, much to the chagrin of both groups. And I had to sort of convince them that this kind of behavior about ourselves was necessary. And over the years, I've had a lot of feedback from people. Some of your very staunch Nazi-type Mormons will come up to me, stop me in the street sometimes and say, "You write terrible things. I want you to know that in spite of it all, I know the church is true." And I agree with them. And I say, "Yeah, but what's that got to do with the fact that you're an idiot?" Simply having the truth or believing you have the truth does not automatically make you smarter. In fact, it often works to your detriment. It's sort of like giving a monkey a car. On the other hand, other people will want to try to entice me over to their way of thinking. And the problem is that I have the same problem with their agenda that I have with the agenda of my own people. It's very difficult. And so I end up making fun of them as well. I wrote a column one time where during the Salt Lake mayoral race, I said that who cares if one of the Salt Lake mayoral candidates once shot a couple of nuns in a ballerina when he was in the fourth grade? Maybe they deserved it. And the editor got this letter from the Salt Lake Diocese of the Catholic Church saying, it was particularly the Sisters' Council, we were very offended by Robert Kirby's assertion that some nuns and a ballerina had been shot because maybe they deserved it. This is, you know, yada yada, very offensive, and we want him to stop doing it. So the editor gave me this letter and said, "Now write him a note and make nice with them. They're actually a very good group of women. They're just somewhat insecure because they're surrounded by so many Mormons." So I wrote him a letter of apology. I'm pretty good at that. I said, "Dear nuns, Jay Shelody thoughtfully forwarded your letter to me regarding a column I wrote wherein I stated that some nuns had been shot because maybe they deserved it. I understand why you were upset about this. As a member of the local predominant faith, I am abysmally ignorant of Catholic tolerances regarding satire. Beg your pardon for a remark that was both insensitive and intemperate. Please know that I am both sorry and already going to hell for being a Mormon. So you can actually use people's religion against them sometimes. I mean, because seriously, if you already think I'm damned, what do you expect? So, the social benefits to humor are such that if you can get somebody to laugh with you about yourself, suddenly you're a little bit less that stereotypical thing they thought you were before. You're a little bit more interesting to know. And suddenly you start finding common ground where you didn't think common ground existed before. I first learned this on an LDS mission to South America, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth. I was sent at the end of my mission to a very small town called San Jose, where everybody hated us. It was at the end of the Vietnam War. To the people who lived there, we were just these two tall, rich, blonde North American kids who'd been sent down to bug them about Jesus, and they didn't want anything to do with us, and I couldn't blame them. And so they would throw things at us and call us names and slam the doors in our faces. And it was at the end of my mission, I had a rather large dog. His name was Lurch. And we weren't supposed to have dogs, but I had one. And I also had a very new junior companion. And one day, because I was bored with the way things were going in San Jose, I put a pair of gym shorts on the dog. And also a white shirt and a necktie. And a name tag. And I told my companion, come on, we're going to go to work. And he was understandably mortified by this. He said, you're not really going to take the dog out dressed like that, are you? I said, yeah, why? And he says, well, what if the mission president sees us? And I said, the mission president? God's watching us right now. What are you worried about the mission president for? And so we took the dog to work, and it turned out just great because my companion was so mortified by this that he wouldn't come to the door with me. He'd stay over there far away, and it worked out beautifully because then I could knock on the door, and people would come to it, and they'd fling it open, and here's the damn Mormons again. And there's two bikes, and there's two briefcases, and there's two Mormons, but one of them's a dog. And if you don't even look at the dog, they don't know what to do. They know something's not right, but would it be rude to mention it? And so they would just sort of stand there waiting for this other shoe to drop, and it never did. And while they're waiting, you could do your spiel. Hi, I'm Elder Kirby, Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints. They're still stuck on the dog. And we did that for a couple of weeks and eventually had to quit doing it because my companion started running out of white shirts. Turns out there's a reason why dogs don't wear them. And also the assistants to the president found out we were doing this, and they jumped in the only mission car and shot out to San Jose at light speed and got us in our apartment and said, you're giving people the wrong idea about the church. You got to quit doing this. And they said, and it also says in the missionary handbook right here that you're not even supposed to have pets, so you have to get rid of this dog. And that was my first serious sunstone moment. Because I looked at them and I said, or what? And turns out, or what, wasn't good enough, and so I kept the dog. I mean, when you're an unpaid volunteer and kind of at the end of your period of service, they don't really know what to do. So I kept the dog, but we stopped doing it, and we never converted anybody because of Lurch. But something better happened, in my estimation, and that was suddenly everybody stopped calling us names. Suddenly we stopped being that stereotypical thing we thought they thought we were, and started being someone who might be interesting to know. And so when we heard that we were in the neighborhood, they would come out and meet us. They didn't slam their doors anymore, and we made a lot of really good friends. And most of the time, that's the best you can hope for. You can't ever bring everyone around to your way of thinking. It just won't happen. And so why not make a friend out of them? And I tell everybody that occasionally life tries to teach us this in very terrible ways. When the towers collapsed, everybody remembers looking at them and thinking, that is horrible. And suddenly it didn't make any difference what religion you professed, what your politics were, what color you were, what your gender orientation was. Suddenly we were all brothers and sisters. And as we come away from that, as we get further removed from that terrible moment, we're back to digging these really stupid moats and putting people back in boxes because the thinking's built right in and we don't have to treat them as individuals. And we shouldn't do that. But we do. I believe that laughter is the non-punishing way of learning how to deal with that problem. There are other ways that God tries to teach us that, I suppose. They're more painful. Those are the noble reasons why I do what I do, but there's also the selfish reason. The truth of the matter is that I'm still just a little kid teasing a dog through a fence with a stick, trying to provoke a reaction. I work at the church's family history library in Springville now, and people who come in to do their genealogy there tend to be really focused about it, and so you can have a lot of fun with them. They'll bring a disc in and say, got all my ancestors on here, and I need to get it ready to go to the temple. And if you take it from them and you say, well, you're sure everybody's passed on this disc, because if we have to kill them for you, it costs extra. Most people will laugh. But there are those few, those precious, precious few, who will look at you like maybe they missed something in church. The best moment I ever had doing that was when a gospel doctrine teacher, that was the Old Testament, asked me what my favorite Old Testament story was. And I have a reputation in my ward, so everybody kind of turned to see what my favorite Old Testament story would be. And I said it was about the Ark of the Covenant, you know, how it contained the might and the strength of God, and how it was stole by these Nazis and put on a submarine. And taken to this island where everybody got their face melted. And there were people who started going through their... They're looking for U-boat in the Concordance. I put a sign on the wall down at the library not too long ago, and this kind of sums up how I truly feel about humor. Put a sign up on the wall down there. It was kind of a... And there's so many signs and directives on the wall at the Family History Library that this one just blended right in. And it said, attention library patrons, beginning in the year 2000, the LDS Church will no longer do temple work for the French. And people would come in and see that, and they would stress. Because it looked official, and nobody else other than an official would put a sign up there. So they'd go, oh dear, the poor French. First the Jews and now the French. What are we going to do? After a couple days, the librarian saw it and she tore it down. Figured out that it wasn't Boyd K. Packer who'd put it up there. That's when some people down there got really mad at me, because suddenly they realized that somebody had been having fun at their expense over something they considered to be very sacred. And this one older brother came to me and said, that was a very sacrilegious thing to do. I said, yeah, maybe, but it was sort of funny too, right? And he said, well, I don't think so. And I said, I know, that's the funny part. Questions about what I do? Yes.
I would like to say that it is so refreshing to hear someone stand up, give a talk about humor that is neither demeaning nor vulgar. Thank you for the privilege.
Oh, thanks. Yes. I believe that you can actually use humor in virtually every case in life. As a police officer, one time I interviewed a woman who had been sexually assaulted a couple months before, and she was describing what had the act that had been committed on her, and suddenly she started to laugh when she was recounting how clumsy her assailant was, how non-performing her assailant was, and because she was laughing, I laughed at her, and I apologized to her. And she said, no, you don't need to. She says, I've kind of come to understand that when I can get to the point where I can get other people to laugh with me about what happened to me, that's a sign that I can get over this, that I can put it behind me. So in the context of sex, for example, it's pretty doggone funny when you think about it a certain way, but there's nothing really funny about the sexual abuse of children. And while you can use humor to help you get over the terrible effects of a sexual assault, the issue for a humorist becomes what can I use, what can I sell to the audience to make them laugh? And obviously, I don't have any rape jokes, sorry. And so, yeah, there are areas where you don't go. Sexual assault of children's and off limits. I don't make fun. I try not to make fun of people as individuals. Everybody makes mistakes, and so I've done that, made the mistake of lampooning individuals in the past and realized later on that you're not just hurting them, you're hurting their family too, and people who love them. So I tend to stay away from individuals and go for groups. Groups are so much better because the target is bigger. I'm lazy. I'm not stupid. Yes?
Yeah. Have you get your message across?
Yeah.
And what kind of reaction do you get?
The reaction I've always gotten has been very positive. The first time it ever happened was I was at a conference for Christians and Jews in Salt Lake. And the lines were kind of passing each other, and everybody was shaking each other's hands. And I looked down there, and here comes James Faust. And I was right in the middle of a lot of controversy about the things that I'd written. And so I thought, oh, this is going to be painful. And he got up to me and grabbed me and gave me a hug and said, you columnist, you. I don't know whether that was good or bad, but the time I was scared the most, though, was when at the dedication of the new science building at BYU, I was late for it. I was covering it as a regular news story, and I rounded this corner in the lower level and came face-to-face with President Hinckley's entourage coming toward me. And I was still new at doing this humor thing about Mormons, and so I kind of slid over against the wall to let him go by. It was this really old woman in a flowered print dress with her husband and about 40 guys in dark suits behind him. It looked really weird. So I got over against the wall, and as they passed by, President Hinckley looked over me and goes, hi, Robert. I said, hi, President. And then I thought, oh, crap. Yeah, Omar? No.
There are no stand-ups in the church. There's people that sing and dance and perform, but there is no tradition of stand-up.
I have a theory about that. I believe that it is because I don't know how many of you have read The Prince by Machiavelli, where he talks about if a ruler has to choose between making between ruling by love and ruling by fear, he should always choose fear, because you can make people fear you whenever you want, but people love of their own volition. And in the church, it's easier to make people behave themselves using guilt than it is by using humor, because you can't control what will make people laugh. Something is either funny or it isn't. But you can control what you can make them feel guilty about. Yeah, but they always end up being sort of weeded out after a while. No, I just don't expect to go anywhere. I mean, I'm not in a bishopric anymore. There's a reason. I mean, if they sent me off to the Family History Center because they figured, well, he can't hurt dead Mormons. So let's put him down there. Other questions? Yes.
Have you ever had a period in your life when nothing seemed very funny?
Yeah. I get those very often. I mean, humorists get writer's block like everybody else. When I get really blocked, I go to church. I mean, it's true. I tell everybody that congregations, regardless of whether they're Mormon or Protestant or whatever, are like little villages. I mean, there's a head man and a council and an alpha female, and always one or two village idiots. And there are people who will get up in church sometime and say, "Oh, last week one of the three Nephites helped me change a tire." And my ward, they don't say stuff like that anymore. This is true. I actually had the stake president stop stake conference one time, find me in the audience and say, "Robert, this is all off the record." I mean, you get your best humor just watching people. I mean, and we talk about how funny the Orthodox Mormons are and how they don't really have a sense of their own irony. But the truth of the matter is I can come out of here with three or four columns about you. Because in your own way, you're a lot like them. What? Yeah, it'll be online. Eventually. If I still have a job when I go home. Yes?
When you want to be serious or sacred, either in council with your family or members of the board or a member, do you have like a Steve Martin problem where they won't take you seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's difficult sometimes because I've learned that I can be funny about Mormons, but can I be other things besides just this guy who knows how to make people laugh? And so that's difficult. The last book I wrote that I just turned in is a history of Utah's murdered police officers, starting from the first one in 1858 all the way up to the beginning, or to the modern times. And when my list of titles is announced in situations like this, people always laugh about the titles. And they'll get to that one, you know, his book about Utah's murdered police officers, and they'll laugh. I think, but... I mean, it's a struggle to change. Okay, our time's up. I appreciate it. If you have any other questions, just come up and ask me when we're done. Thanks.